So differential forms are a special kind of tensors, and they're linear combinations, and they're important because they are important for differentiation, for integration. You can't integrate without differential forms. Now, let's build up to the differential forms. Remember that we defined the cotangent space, TPM star, at the point P in the following way. We said that the cotangent space consists of all cotangent vectors, and each cotangent vector is a linear map that takes as input a tangent vector and outputs a number. So a cotangent vector omega maps a tangent vector or tangent vectors into numbers. So omega maps a tangent vector that we may call xi into some number that we call omega of xi. And that's a special case, the cotangent space of a tensor space. The cotangent vector space is the space of covariant 0, 1 tensors. So each cotangent vector is a covariant tensor of rank 0, 1. Now, these cotangent vectors and their tensor products are particularly important. So let us consider the tensor product of many copies of the cotangent space. So let us consider all covariant R tensors. So a covariant R tensor is an element of the tensor product of R copies of the cotangent space. If nu is a covariant R tensor, then what does it do? What's its job? Its job is that it's a multilinear map, which, given that it's covariant, maps tangent vectors, R of them, R tangent vectors, into a number. Just like a covariant tensor of rank 0, 1 maps one tangent vector into a number, an element of this space maps R tangent vectors into a number. So if nu is an element of that space of covariant R tensors, and if xi1 to xi r are R tangent vectors, so each one of these xi's is a tangent vector, each one is an element of TP of M, then we can feed them as input into this covariant R tensor, and we obtain a number, nu of xi1 to xi r. We obtain differential forms by focusing on a subset of these covariant R tensors. So let's consider the case where R is larger than 1, because the case where R is 0 and the case where R is 1 is trivial. We know them already, right? If R is 1, then we just talk about covariant tensors. Cotangent vectors. So let's assume R is larger than 1, so we have at least two copies of the cotangent space. Then we can anti-symmetrize those tensors. We could also symmetrize them, but for a reason that will become clear a little later, it's particularly important to consider the anti-symmetrization of these covariant R tensors. In order to define this anti-symmetrization, we introduce an anti-symmetrization operator, an anti-symmetrization map. What it does is it takes in one of those covariant R tensors and anti-symmetrizes it. So if nu is one of those covariant R tensors, then nu tilde is defined to be the anti-symmetrized version of it. And how does that work? Well, we can explain what nu tilde is by explaining what it does. So what does nu tilde do if you feed it R tangent vectors? Well, what it does is the following. you take these R tangent vectors and plug them into new, the unsymmetrized, original covariant R tensor, and you get out a number, right? And then you multiply that with the so-called signature of the sequence in which you put these indices. So for example, you can put in here Xi1, Xi2, Xi3, up until Xi R, but you can also reorder them in any which way you want. And we have to sum over all possible orderings of these input vectors, and each ordering is either even or odd, meaning that you get to it from the standard ordering by either doing an even or odd number of permutations. And that's what the signature here captures. It captures whether that permutation, whether that sequence, whether that ordering is an even or an odd one. If it's an even one, this is a 1. If it's an odd one, this is a minus 1. So we are summing over all of these, over all possible permutations in which the input vectors could be plugged into new, with respective signs, depending on whether the permutation is positive or negative, even or odd, and then we normalize with a 1 over R factorial, because there are R factorial ways to order them. And we call this operation of plugging these in all possible perturbations, in all possible permutations into here, and then multiplying with the sign and summing over all of it and then normalizing it, we call this operation A. Okay, so that's the anti-symmetrization map. I promised I'd tell you why we're interested in anti-symmetrizing them rather than symmetrizing them. That has to do with the fact that, as I said, differential forms are important because they are the only things that can be integrated. But why is that? What we want is that integration is a concept that tells us something that's coordinate system independent. For example, we may want to know what's the volume of a manifold, or the area of a manifold, or something like that. Of course, that should be independent of what coordinate system we choose to calculate it. Now, you know that when you do a multidimensional integral and you change variables, then you get, through the change of variables, a chain rule factor, which in the multidimensional case is called a Jacobian determinant. Right? Remember that? When you change variables in a multidimensional integral, you get a Jacobian determinant. And if you remember determinants, they're full of minus signs. As many minus signs as plus signs, right? And what we need, if we want to define integration in multiple dimensions, what we need is that the change of variables doesn't mess with the result, which means that Jacobian factor needs to be undone, right? And that's why we need this total anti-symmetrization here. This will provide an antidote to that Jacobian factor so that actually we can define integration and the result will be independent of the choice of variables with which we calculate it. And it has to be the covariant ones because, again, the anti-symmetry is not enough. It also has to transform in the right way. Remember that according to the physicist's definition of cotangent space, the transformation properties of tangent and cotangent vectors are different. And we need it such that the Jacobian factor cancels out. If we anti-symmetrized the contravariant tensors, then we would not get the cancellation of the Jacobian factors. We would get that we square it because we get 2 of them, right? Okay, that's just anticipating. We will see this play out in practice a little later. Okay, so we take this space of covariant R tensors, and then we say, okay, we can actually take one of those, each one of them, and anti-symmetrize it. So concretely, I see. Just a moment. I need to, oh boy, how do I do that? All right, I have to do it this way then. Okay, concretely, let's say, for example, that nu is one of those covariant R tensors, and let's say it's a two tensor. So it's an element of the covariant of the space of covariant two tensors, so an element of the space that you obtain by taking a tensor product of two cotangent spaces. So let's say nu is one of those, and let's give an explicit example. For example, this is a cotangent vector, df. dg is a cotangent vector. If you take the tensor product of the two, then we get an element of this space here. Any linear combination of such things would also be a covariant two tensor. We could choose here for f, we could choose a coordinate function. It could be dxi, but we don't have to. It could be any function, right? For any functions f and g, or function germs, we get cotangent vector here, cotangent vector there. So that's one of those elements. Then how does it act? Well, its business is to digest two tangent vectors. So we can put two tangent vectors into there and get a number out. So nu of two tangent vectors, xi1 and xi2, gives us what value? It gives us a number, and that number is obtained by plugging the first cotangent, first tangent vector into this component, into this cotangent vector, and that tangent vector into this cotangent vector, and that gives us two numbers. That's a number, and this is a number. How would we actually evaluate it? Remember, what is df on a tangent vector? Remember what a tangent vector is. It is a directional derivative. It's a sum over coefficients times partial derivatives. And what is the action of df on xi1? Well, it is xi1 on f. Right? Remember that the df is a cotangent vector, and it evaluates on a tangent vector by taking the tangent vector and acting with it on the function, and then that directional derivative is a number. That's what this evaluates to. So in practice, that's xi1 of f times xi2 of g. That's how we would evaluate that. Plug in two tangent vectors in there and get a number out. And those are two arbitrary functions. Okay, so now let's anti-symmetrize this covariant two tensor. So nu tilde of xi1 and xi2 is then obtained by this procedure. We have to write it in all, we have to plug into nu all possible permutations, well, only two of them, because it's only two, right? And then with a sign and with a factor of 1/2 in this case. So we have df dg, and then plugging in xi1, xi2, that's a positive sequence. And then here we plug in xi2, xi1, that's a negative sequence, because we've done an odd number of permutations, namely 1. So we get a minus sign. This 1/2 is the 1 over r factorial for r equal to 2. So what we see is that the anti-symmetrized version of df tensor dg is given by that. Because this is to be true for all tangent vectors, this is, we can also write it without the tangent vectors in this way. Okay, so we've just as anti-symmetrized one of those covariant two tensors. Now it turns out that this operation here, this anti-symmetrization, is what is called a projector. Now what's a projector? A projector is any operation which gives the same any number of times you apply it. If you apply it once or 100 times, it gives you the same. So a projector has always the property, or is defined by the property, that applying it once is the same as applying it twice. So in our case, we can apply this and go through this calculation and find, yes, that's true, we get the same thing again. Now, let us define now the space of differential forms. We are ready now, we have all the tools for this. And we consider the case for r larger than 1, because otherwise we can't anti-symmetrize, right? We have to at least have two cotangent vectors, a covariant two tensor in order to be able to anti-symmetrize. So let's assume for now that r is larger than 1. Then we define the space of differential R forms, or also called the exterior R forms, in the following way, and we will denote it by capital lambda index R of P. So we anticipate now that, I will just say you now, tell you now, that this is going to be a subspace of the space of covariant R tensors. It's going to be the antisymmetric one. There's a set of antisymmetric ones. So lambda R of P, the set of differential R forms, also called the set of exterior R forms, at a point P on the manifold, is defined to be the subspace of totally antisymmetric tensors of rank 0R, so of covariant R tensors. And we can write this in a very succinct way by saying that lambda R of P, the set of differential R forms, is equal to what you obtain when you apply the anti-symmetrization operator and all elements of the vector space of covariant R forms. So in particular, since we know that A is a projector, we know that if we take a tensor or a differential form, if we take an already anti-symmetrized covariant R tensor, so if nu is an element of the space of differential R forms, then its nu tilde, its anti-symmetrized version, is itself, because it's already starting out completely anti-symmetric. And in practice, of course, total anti-symmetry means that if you take your covariant R tensor that's totally anti-symmetric and you feed it tangent vectors, you get a number out, and if you exchange any two of these tangent vectors, if you exchange the sequence of any two of them, then the number that you get out flips its sign. That's what anti-symmetry means. That is what we design by doing this, right? Because all odd permutations become even, all even become odd permutations if you do that. So this, all of these signs flip. That's total anti-symmetry. Now, this all may sound a little tedious now, but don't despair. As it will turn out, you have seen all of this before, maybe in a different way. We will see a lot of stuff that you know before from, I don't know, electrodynamics, for example, will pop out as special cases. And something that might look mysterious in electrodynamics becomes a special case of some a grander theory here. Oh, we don't want to go this far. Okay, so here we are. We looked at, we defined the space of differential R forms. And this was for R larger equal to 1. What about R equal to 1 or R equal to 0? Are there any 0 forms, any 1 forms? And there are. And we've known them already. We just didn't call them this way. For R equal to 0, we define the set of differential 0 forms at the point, and that's simply the real numbers. And when we extend this to all of the manifold, then it will be just the scalar valued function. So lambda 0 at the point is just the real numbers. And then for R equal 1, we also have a definition of differential 1 forms. And the differential 1 forms are simply the cotangent vectors. Okay, so differential 0 forms are just functions, or at a point, just numbers. Differential 1 forms are the cotangent vectors. And the differential R forms are covariant R tensors that have been completely anti-symmetrized. So it looks like all we did is consider a particular subset of the set of covariant tensors. But actually, we are going to do something pretty wild now. Because we are going to take this vector space and turn it into an algebra. You see, Cotangent vectors form a vector space, the cotangent space. And then the covariant three tensors, for example, form a vector space of covariant three tensors. But you would not normally think that you could write down, for example, a 2x2 matrix and add to it, let's say, 3 times this plus 7 times, and here you have a 3x3 matrix. And then maybe for good measure you add a number. You wouldn't do that normally, right? Would you? We're going to do this now. You see, there are zero forms, there are one forms, there are two forms, three forms, etc. We're going to add them up willy-nilly. So we would not normally add these things, right? Because how the heck would we do that? How do we add this thing to this? Well, the same way that we've always added vectors. You see, if you have, for example, E1 is a basis vector, and you have that E2 is a basis vector, you can write down a linear combination in the form of, and let's say E3 is a basis vector, then you can write down a linear combination in the form of 3 E1 plus 7 E2 plus 4 E3, right? There's no question about it. It's a linear thing. You just add them up. That's the same thing we do here. This would be E1, this would be E2, this would be E3. You see? You don't have to plug those numbers into there. This is a basis vector, and that matrix would be a basis vector, and you can take multiples of those. You can do that. Why not? If you do this, then you obtain a vector space, because all you need to obtain a vector space is that you can add any two of those, and you get another one of that set, and you multiply with a number, and you get one of those, this set. I could, for example, take this vector and multiply it with 100. And what I would get is that this is equal to 300 times this matrix plus 700 times that matrix plus 400 times that number. Okay? All right. So what we will do with differential forms, and we would not normally do this with tensors, but with differential forms we will do that. We will consider the vector space of linear combinations of all differential forms, of zero forms, one forms, R forms, etc. And then, to top it up, we will allow to multiply them. Right? And then we have to ask, how do we do that? How do we multiply a two form with a three form, and a one form with a five form, and so on? So we will look at a multiplication of differential forms. So what we then obtain, and it should be an associative multiplication to obtain an associative algebra. Okay, so that's what we will do. We will take the differential forms, R forms, all of them, I mean one, zero forms, one forms, two forms, etc., and we allow ourselves to add them, and we will also define a multiplication among them in an associative way, such that we obtain an algebra. And once we have an algebra, what are we going to do then? Then we are going to look at the derivations of that algebra. And that will give us notions of differentiation in an algebraic way. Okay, and then the opposite of that will be integration, roughly speaking. All right. So the strategy will be we define a multiplication. I mean, we allow ourselves to add them. And we define a multiplication, we obtain an algebra, and then we look at derivations, which is linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule, that obey the product rule. Okay, so the veg product. How are we going to multiply an S form and an R form at a point? So we define the multiplication of these two R forms in the following way. We will call it a veg. It's going to be the veg product. And the veg product is defined in such a way that if you take an R form and wedge multiply it with an S form, you get an R plus S form. So the wedge product of a 1 form and a 2 form is a 3 form, for example. And here is exactly how it works. You take 2 forms, let's say omega is an R form, nu is an S form, then it's going to be mapped by the wedge product into this differential form. It's omega wedge nu. And it's supposed to be a differential form, right? Because the algebra must what is called close, which means that if you take any 2 elements and multiply them, you get another element of that algebra. And therefore, since all of these elements are anti-symmetric, this has to be a differential form. Okay, so you multiply these 2 differential forms in the following way. You take their tensor product. That's simple. But then you anti-symmetrize that, and you may want to employ a machine for this if it's big. And then this is just to normalize the whole thing. Okay, so that's if R and S are not zero, so if they're not just numbers. But if one of them is actually zero, so, if one of these 2 numbers is zero, so if C is a zero form, which at a point means it's just a real number, and omega is some S form, then the wedge product of them is just the ordinary multiplication. You could write the wedge product if you want, but it's defined to be just the ordinary multiplication. It's just because we want to carry the linearity through. Okay, now let's look at an example where we take a 1 form and a 1 form, and we want to multiply them, we want to wedge multiply them to get a 2 form. So let's say we choose this 1 form and that 1 form. You know, the differential of this coordinate function and the differential of that coordinate function. Then the wedge product of the 2, by this definition here, is dxi tensor dxj. You see, we take the tensor product, but then we have to anti-symmetrize it. So we have to write it one way and the other way. And with a minus sign, if we flip the order. And then here we have a 1 plus 1 is 2 factorial divided by 1, 1. So this is a factor of 2. But the anti-symmetrization comes itself with a prefactor of 1 half. So we don't have any prefactor here. Okay, so now we've seen an example of how you multiply 2 differential forms, in this case 2 1 forms, to obtain a 2 form. That's a 2 form, and it qualifies as a differential form because it is anti-symmetric, as we can see. If you evaluate that on 2 tangent vectors, then you get here a value and here a value. And if you flip the 2, if you rename psi 1, psi 2, and psi 2, psi 1, then you get the negative sign. So it's anti-symmetric. So what are the properties of this new kind of multiplication? Which, remember, actually turns the vector space of differential forms into an algebra. Because now we can not only add these differential forms, we can also multiply them in this wedge way. So what are the properties of this wedge product? Well, it's linear in the sense that if you take a differential form plus another differential form, wedge a third differential form, then this works out distributively, as if it was an ordinary multiplication. Also, if A is a zero form, that is to say, if A is a number, because we are working at a point of the manifold at the moment, if A is a number, then you can multiply it onto the first factor or the second factor or pull it out of it. It's all working out nicely linearly. The wedge product, and that's a non-trivial statement now, we have to check that, is also associative, which means that the wedge product of omega with nu and then wedged with eta is the same as if you took omega and then wedged it with the wedge product of nu and eta. You just have to go through the math to verify that that's true. Also, the wedge product is graded commutative. For example, here we saw that it is anti-commutative. It's anti-commuting, right? Because if you put here dxj veg dxi, you get the same thing with I and j reversed, you get a minus sign. But not always. It turns out, and again, that takes some working out, if you take an R form and an S form and take the veg product between the two of them, then you don't necessarily get minus nu veg omega. It depends on what the product of R and S is. So for example, if R is 1 and S is 2, and this is a 2 and this is a plus 1. So the veg product of a 1 form and a 2 form is actually commutative. Of course, what you get out of it is still a differential form, which means it's anti-symmetric as far as its arguments are concerned. It's just that this differential form may or may not be the negative of that differential form. So keep that in mind. The veg product is not necessarily anti-commuting. It depends on what the product is of the two grades. So what is this veg product useful for? It's going to be useful for a lot of things, but for now we can use it to build bases in the vector spaces. So let's say that, for example, the theta I are a choice of bases in the cotangent space, so in lambda 1. Let's say we choose a basis in lambda 1. And we know a canonical choice of bases. If we have a coordinate system, and then we have coordinate functions, and we already established that their differentials, the dxi, form a basis of the cotangent space. So we could choose those, but of course we could also choose some linear combination of these in such a way that it's invertible, and so we obtain another basis, right? But this is a choice of bases, the theta I. But I just want to give an example. We can choose whatever basis we want. Then, it turns out that if you write down the veg product of R of them, so theta I1, veg theta I2, etc., take R of them, and you order them in such a way that you have only increasing indices up here, then you obtain a basis of the space of differential R forms. Now, why would we want to order them? Well, you see, if we don't order them, then we get repetitions. Because if we just switch two of them, for example, right, then the switching is the switching of two 1 forms. And we know that's anti-commutative, right? So we just get the same thing up to a minus sign. So that wouldn't be a different basis vector. If, on the other hand, we chose two of these indices to be the same, well, then switching should give a minus sign, but it's the same thing, so that is zero. So that wouldn't give a basis vector at all. So therefore, in order to get basis vectors, we need to have them all in increasing order or all in decreasing order, and in such a way that no two indices are actually the same. So one can prove straightforwardly that these, the set of all of those, forms a basis. They actually span the space of differential R forms. But that tells us what the dimension is of the space of differential R forms, because we can ask how many ways are there to take those basis vectors and plug R of them next to each other in such a way that the indices are strictly increasing. And it turns out that this is n choose R, where n is the dimension of the manifold, therefore the number of different thetas, theta i's. And then R is the number of thetas that we veg multiply. So therefore the number of basis vectors that we get in this way is given by n choose r, which is n factorial over r factorial times n minus r factorial, just on combinatorial grounds. Therefore, the dimension of the vector space of differential r forms at a point is given by this quantity, And if you remember that quantity here, oh, you can also see it from here, it is symmetric in exchanging r for n minus r. And what that means is that the dimension of the space of differential r forms, as r goes from 1 to larger numbers, it starts with r equal to n, with the dimension equal to n, because the dimension of the tangent space is the dimension of the manifold. And then the dimension goes up, and then it goes down again. And eventually it goes to 0. If you have an n-dimensional manifold, then it doesn't have differential forms of degree higher than n. Because for that, you would need to have more than n unequal tangent basis vectors from the tangent space. And you can't have that, right? And if you use equal ones, then because of the anti-symmetry, you get a 0. So the space of differential forms is not infinite dimensional. You have only the dimension of the space of differential R forms is this. And if R exceeds n, then it's 0 because of the anti-symmetry here.
I think this part is clear to me, but I'm still confused about the addition operation there. So you're saying we kind of like are combining all of those for like all the different
Yes, we will add them up in the direct sum set.
Oh, okay.
It's a direct sum.
Okay.
That's right. We will get to this in a moment. I was only anticipating it. It will be written up in the next slide. So your question is very timely. Oh, I shouldn't put it all that way, because I want you to see the previous slides to remember that. Okay, so for example, let's say we choose a point on a three-dimensional manifold, and to make it simple, let's just choose R3. In this case, what are the zero forms, lambda zero? I didn't write it here. The zero forms, does anybody remember? Yeah, it's actually at the point, so it's just scalars. It's just numbers, it's R. So lambda 0 is R. And lambda 1 is the cotangent space. So it's the span, it's the set of linear combinations of, that's the span of these basis vectors of the cotangent space. And then lambda 2 is the set of all veg products, is the set spanned by the veg products, where we have to choose them in increasing order, right? So it's dx1, dx2, dx1, dx3, and dx2, dx3, right? There are only three possibilities to do that. So that means lambda 2 is three-dimensional, lambda 1 is three-dimensional, and lambda 3 is also three-dimensional. There's only one way that we can write these three basis vectors in with increasing sequence of the indices. Okay, so we go from lambda 0, which is one-dimensional, to lambda 3, which is one-dimensional, and those two in the middle are three-dimensional. Right, and now we define the set of all differential forms at that point, lambda of p, to be the direct sum of all of these R forms, where I runs from 0 to the dimension of the manifold. And that is not only a vector space, you know, vector space in that sense, right? It's not only a vector space, it's also an algebra, because we have this veg product, and we know how to multiply any differential forms with any other differential form. And this is called the Grassmann algebra, it's also called the exterior algebra. This was all at a point. And there was a good reason to do that, because it allowed us to count the dimensions. If we now generalize this to fields, then the set of zero forms, zero form fields, is infinite dimensional, because you have an infinite dimensional function space. But at the point, it's just one dimension, it's just R, right? And similarly here at a point, this is a three-dimensional space, but if you look at the set of all cotangent vector fields, well, that's of course infinite dimensional, right? So it's useful to sometimes just focus on a point. All right, so a differential form field is a mapping that associates to every point in the manifold an element of this Grassmann algebra. And this is, and these differential form fields are also usually just called differential forms. We don't distinguish that. All right, so these fields form the Grassmann algebra of differential forms. So on one hand, we get an algebra here. And algebra is good to have because we can then consider the derivations of an algebra. And that gives us versions of derivatives without having to bother with epsilons and deltas, which is very important because we don't want to be bothered with coordinate systems. We want to do things in a coordinate system independent way. But in order to do delta epsilon definitions of derivatives, we would have to choose a coordinate system always. And then we would have in hindsight to prove that it doesn't matter which coordinate system we chose. So it's better to use the algebraic definition where coordinate systems don't come up. Now, there is another reason too for why we may want to consider this Grassmann algebra. We will touch upon that later in the course. You may wonder, is there anything physical? Do you know of any examples of where something is a linear combination of one forms, two forms, and three forms, and God forbid, whatever, right? Does that anywhere come up? Do you know any example of that? As we will see later on, spinners live there. Right? So they are not just external to, I mean, it's often thought that you have the scalars, you have the vectors, you have the tensors, and then spinners are a different kind of animal. No, they live in there. And they have a different multiplication too. Anyway, so we will see all of that later. So generalization to fields is straightforward. Now, remember that given an algebra, it is often useful to consider derivations of the algebra. So for example, we had this algebra of function germs. But now we have this algebra of differential forms. And what are going to be derivations of this algebra of differential forms? Well, there are going to be multiple different kinds of derivations. And the derivations that we will consider here are the exterior derivation and the inner derivation. Later, we will also consider other algebras with other derivations. Differential geometry has a lot of derivations, lots of different derivatives. OK, so let's define what exactly we mean by derivation of a Grassmann algebra. So our derivation is going to be a map that maps differential forms into differential forms, the differentiated differential form. Now, there are going to be multiple derivations, and they will all have their own names and their own symbol, their own symbols. Generally, let's just call a derivation phi, capital phi, right? And later, concrete derivations will have concrete different names. But generally, a linear map that maps a differential form into a differential form, an element of the Grassmann algebra of differential forms into an element of the Grassmann algebra of differential forms, is a derivation if it obeys the Leibniz rule, if it obeys the product rule. But it's a bit more subtle. There's a bit more fine-grainedness to it. We can say that a linear map phi that maps the Grassmann algebra into the Grassmann algebra is called the derivation of degree k. And we have this option now because the Grassmann algebra has degrees, right? There are differential R forms and R plus 1 forms, R plus 2 forms, etc., 1 form, 2 form, 3 forms. So we say that it's a derivation of degree k if it maps S forms into S plus k forms. So for example, our derivation or derivative could be mapping, cotangent vectors into three forms, etc. But the k doesn't even have to be positive. It could also be negative. You could have a derivation that maps three forms into two forms, four forms into three forms, etc. We will get an example of this. Okay, so a linear map is called a derivation of degree k if it maps s forms into s plus k forms, where k might be negative. And it does it in the following way, obeying the product rule. So if it acts on a differential form alpha veg a differential form beta, then it has to differentiate the first, leaving the second the same, plus leaving the first differential form the same, and then differentiating the second differential form. That's the usual product rule. And that's supposed to be true then for all elements of the Grassmann algebra. So it's still in the spirit of a derivation is a linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule, just a little bit more subtle because it can mess with the degree, can increase it or decrease it, depending on what kind of derivation we have. And we can define, and we will define because it's useful, also so-called antiderivations. So a linear map, it's called phi again, that maps the Grassmann algebra elements into Grassmann algebra elements is called an antiderivation of degree k if it maps S forms into S plus K forms, and it obeys the Leibniz rule, but with a minus sign in the second term, potentially. And whether or not it has a minus sign there depends on the degree of the form here. So if alpha is a Q form, then depending on whether Q is even or odd, we either have a plus or a minus sign here. Clearly, that's a definition that's designed for a purpose. That's because the so-called, we'll see. There are derivations that are antiderivations. Now, it might seem that it will be difficult to define derivations and antiderivations because we would have to define how a derivation acts on zero form. How a derivation acts on one forms, how it acts on two forms, on three forms, on four forms, and so on, right? And then we will have to check that the whole thing is consistent, etc., etc. But it turns out it's life is easier than this. Namely, and as we will see in a moment, because of the Leibniz rule and because of linearity, it turns out that in order to define a derivation or an antiderivation, it suffices to define how it acts on zero forms, which is to say on functions, and to define how it acts on a basis of one forms. From that, it's already induced how it will act on all differential forms. And the reason is the Leibniz rule and linearity. Right? If, for example, you have a differential three form, and you may wonder, how does this act on a differential three form? Well, because of the Leibniz rule, you can decompose that three form. You can say it's a one form a two form, or a linear combination of expressions like that. And then with the Leibniz rule, you can work that out. But then you still have to know how it acts on two forms. But they, again, you can decompose using the product rule. And so in this way, you can always boil it down to how it acts on zero forms, the prefactors, and how it acts on the one forms. And you don't even need to know how it acts on all one forms. You just need to know how it acts on the basis of the one forms, because then by linearity, you get all the one forms too. So we need to know how it acts on the basis of the one forms and on the zero forms. And we get started by defining the exterior derivative. There's going to be an exterior derivative or derivation, and there's going to be an inner derivative or inner derivation. So the exterior derivation is called D. So, you know, we said phi is, you know, capital phi is the abstract thing. Anything, any phi that obeys such and such is called a derivation. Here's a concrete example of such a phi, and that's this little d here. And this will be very closely related to the differential d that we had before. In fact, the differential d that we had before is a special case of it. So we define the exterior derivative or derivation, and it's going to be a map. I mean, it has the ambition of being called a derivation, so it has to act on the Grassmann algebra and map into the Grassmann algebra. And exterior derivative, exterior derivation is, we define it to be an antiderivation of degree k equal to plus 1. In order to define it, all we need to do is we need to explain, we need to define how the d acts on zero forms and how it acts on one forms, how it acts on functions, how it acts on cotangent vectors, on the basis of cotangent vectors. And then by the Leibniz rule and linearity, this induces how it acts on all differential forms automatically. And as long as we don't mess things up in this first step, as long as we give a consistent definition of how this acts on zero forms and how it acts on a basis of one forms, we are fine. It will define an antiderivation just by extending it using linearity in the product rule. And here is how we define it. Very simple. The exterior derivative is defined to act on zero forms in the following way. So d will act on zero forms, maps that into one form. And in which way? Well, it takes a zero form in, that's a function, or at a point it's a function term, it's a function, and it outputs the derivation of that function, which is the differential of it. Now, the differential is a cotangent vector field, right? So it takes a function in, and it outputs a cotangent vector field. So we define the exterior derivative to be the d that we knew before, right? So that's what it does. We define the exterior derivative to be the d that we knew before that maps functions into their differentials. It maps zero forms, therefore, into one forms in this way. But now we still have to specify how this exterior derivative is supposed to act on a basis of one forms. Now we know that these guys form a basis of one forms. And so let's just make life easy and say that it maps them into zero. All right? If we do that, then we've already defined how everything acts, how d acts on everything. You might think that this means that d acts trivially on two forms. It doesn't, because just because it maps these one forms into zero doesn't mean that it maps all one forms into zero. For example, you could have a one form which is a linear combination of these guys with coefficient functions in front of them, so that it becomes some non-trivial cotangent vector field, right? So you have some coefficient function in front of it, which is a zero form, right? Remember that if you have a function in front of this, a function is an element of lambda zero. Right? It's a zero form. So then you have the d acting on that function here times that. By the product rule, when it acts, when it gets to act on that, that's a zero. But by the product rule, it also acts on the function, and that will be non-trivial in general. So in general, d acting on one forms is not zero. It's just zero when acting on those guys. Okay, so let's work that out. In the chart, we had the d acts by mapping functions into these one forms, right? We had that before. And it's, you know, this set of partial derivatives here. And now, more generally, we have the following. I gave you the example of having here one of these basis vectors and a function in front. But much more generally, we could have a differential form which is of the form some coefficient function here. And then here, all of the basis vectors of the space of S forms, right? So we have S factors of basis vectors, and then here we have coefficient functions. And so beta is actually an S form. Every arbitrary S form is of the form that it's a linear combination with these linear combination factors, veg, and here the basis vectors. Remember that these guys, with all the permutations that are ordered in increasing order, give us a basis. So every covariant S form is of this form, where these guys are one forms. Together they form an S form. And these coefficient functions in front are a zero form, just number-valued functions, right? And then when we apply the exterior derivative to this by the Leibniz rule, what we have is that we have two terms. We have one term which is differentiating the beta coefficient, the lambda 0, keeping that the same, plus leaving this the same, and then applying the d on that. But when they apply the d on that, you can use the Leibniz rule, and you will certainly end up with a d squared. Right? You will get a d dxi, which is 0. So therefore, we only get the derivatives here, and that's what's worked out here. We obtain that we get the exterior derivative on this lambda 0 function here, right? And that just gives us d beta by dxj. And then you get the dxj. See, this alone is just the d of that scalar function, right? This much. And then that trailing stuff is just this stuff again. And so what we obtain, and the rest is vanishing, right? Because we have the d acting on these guys there, on these that are already d's. So overall, let's count what's the degree of that differential form. Well, it acquired one more of these basis vectors in here. So the degree went up by 1. That's fine. You see, antiderivation of degree k equal 1. So that's what we get here. Now, so we get this plus terms of this form. Right, but then we said that this is vanishing because if you work this out with the product rule, you get it's d of dxi, it's vanishing, plus et cetera, all of this is vanishing. Now, what we obtain here, and I gave you the proof down here, is that it's a general rule. If you have this rule, if you say that d acting on the cotangent vector, on the cotangent vectors dxi makes them vanish, then this propagates to the entire Grassmann algebra of differential forms, such that we have the d after d is always zero. Not only when you have d acting on a coordinate function, and then apply another d to it, that's zero. No, you can prove, and here's the proof of it, that whenever you apply the d on a differential form and then apply the d again, you always get 0. And it's just an algebraic proof, right? So we take our differential form, and like this one, this is the first exterior derivative application, right? So we apply d once to it, we get this. If we apply it again to this, then we acquire another one of those basis vectors, and we get the second derivative here. And the point is, these guys are anti-symmetric because the veg product guarantees that by its construction. You always, veg product, remember, is to take the tensor product and then anti-symmetrize. So these guys are anti-symmetric in those indices. But the second derivative here is symmetric. So if you exchange j with k, you get the same number here, right? It doesn't matter whether you first differentiate with respect to xk and then with respect to xj or the other way around, same thing. But here you pick up a minus sign. In other words, you're summing over stuff where this is anti-symmetric, this is symmetric, the whole thing therefore is 0. You may wonder, big deal, all right? It's just a little bit of, you know, anti-symmetrization, symmetrization. But it turns out that here we hit upon something, and I'm anticipating what will come later in the course, that is super deep. Because that has to do with something completely geometric. even though this is completely algebraic. See, we don't even need to put in numbers for this. We can just see on the structure of it algebraically that this has to be the case. D after D is equal to zero. And as I said, this turns out to be equivalent to a completely geometric statement. And let me build up to that statement, completely geometric. Consider, for example, a ball. What's its boundary? How do you call the boundary of a ball? Sphere. It's a sphere, right? So if your ball, the boundary of a ball is a sphere. Okay, now, what's the boundary of a sphere? It doesn't have one, right? Right? A sphere doesn't have a boundary. A sphere is a two-dimensional thing that doesn't have a boundary. If you have, for example, a differential equation that lives on a sphere, where would you put boundary conditions? Can't. If you have a differential equation on a ball, yeah, then you have to put boundary conditions on the sphere, right? Okay, so what we see here is that the ball is a 3D object, its boundary is 2D, and its boundary doesn't have itself a boundary. Boundary is empty. Now, let's take the sphere. The sphere, and we chop it in half. So we chop it at the equator. So it's this hollow thing, right? It's a two-dimensional hemisphere. Does it have a boundary?
Circle.
Yeah, it's the equator circle, right? Now, does the equator have, the equator is a one-dimensional thing. Does it have a boundary? No. So what we saw here is two examples of the general geometric phenomenon that boundaries don't have boundaries. Right? You take any shape of any dimension, consider its boundary. That's also some shape. It will not have a boundary. The boundaries of boundaries are empty. Right? That's a purely geometric statement. And it turns out it's the same as that. We will later see that via Stokes' theorem, that's the same as saying that d after d is equal to zero. Which is also why this operator d, the exterior derivative, is also called the co-boundary operator. It's not a boundary operator. The boundary operator takes you from the ball to the sphere and from the hemisphere to the equator. But its dual in some sense, as we will see later, is this guy. Right? So it's pretty cool that in mathematics you can stretch sometimes from a structure that's completely algebraic here, or differential geometric, algebraic really, all the way to something that's completely geometric. Okay, so let us look at an example of such differential forms. Let's say our manifold is R3. You may remember this from electrostatics, for example, if you've done a course on electrostatics. So let's say we have R3, and f is some function in R3, some scalar function in R3. Then its differential is a cotangent vector field, and it is given by this, right? We calculated that. So if f is a function, then the cotangent vector field is given by that. These are the basis vectors at each point, and here are coefficient functions. And how many coefficient functions do we have? Three of them, because our manifold is three-dimensional. So our cotangent vectors have these three components. As it should be, the manifold is three-dimensional, and our cotangent vectors are three-dimensional vectors. In physics, you may have encountered this before, and it was introduced to you as the gradient vector field of a scalar function. Right? It's the gradient, because you take your function f, and then you calculate these derivatives, that's the gradient. But now we know that the gradient is really the cotangent vector field that you obtain by applying the exterior derivation on a scalar function. And an example of that, a physical example in electrostatics, is this. Let's say you have phi is the scalar electrostatic potential, then d of phi is the electric field. So the electric field is a cotangent vector field. It's not a tangent vector field, it's a cotangent vector field, because it has these components. And these components, from the physicist's perspective, that's how they transform. Right? Okay, so now, I wanted to keep this up. Now, let's assume that gamma is an arbitrary covariant vector field. Now, this is a covariant vector field, but it's not an arbitrary one. It's a covariant vector field. It's a cotangent vector field that is derived from a scalar potential. It is obtained by applying the D on a scalar function. But not every cotangent vector field is of that form. And that's very important. It's very important to realize that. That when if I write down three functions here, three arbitrary functions, there is no reason that these three functions can be written as the x1 derivative, the x2 derivative, and the x3 derivative of one scalar function, right? Which means that unlike in calculus of one variable, where every function, almost every function has, I mean, except for pathological cases, every function has an antiderivative. Not so here in multiple dimensions, right? Because you see, the f is like an antiderivative of the cotangent vector field, right? Because this is the derivative of f. So in a sense, f is the antiderivative of the cotangent vector field. But not every cotangent vector field has an integral. Not every cotangent vector field has an f of which it is the gradient. Okay, so now let's look at an arbitrary gamma that may or may not be a gradient vector field. But it's just an arbitrary vector of the cotangent vector field. So it can be written as some linear combination of these basis vectors and those guys, gamma I of x, need not be of this form. They need not exist an f from which they derive. Now, in that case, we have a one form, and we can ask, well, what's the d of that? We know that if we applied the d on this, we should get 0. Because it's already the d of f. If you apply another d on it, it ought to be 0, right? It will be 0. But this is not a gradient vector field in general. So let's work it out. If gamma is a cotangent vector field, in other words, if gamma is a one form, then what's its exterior derivative? Well, there we have to apply the beta. We have to apply the d on it. And the beta is what then? Well, we have to, by the product rule, we are differentiating with d. We are differentiating the lambda 0 part, the function part, leaving that alone, plus leaving this alone, and then differentiating that. But differentiating that gives us a 0. So the only thing we get is this part here, where we have differentiated this. And you see this here, d gamma I by dxj, dxj, that's just the differential of gamma I. Right? This is a function, and that's a tangent vector. But then the dxi is still there, so we have that wedge product. And then in principle, plus, where we leave this the same wedge, the d of that, but d of xi is 0. OK. Now, here we have sum over I and j with arbitrary ordering. Let's reorder that so that it's I smaller than j. So that we have one term which is dx1 veg dx2, for example, and another one which is dx2 veg dx1. They differ by a minus sign. So we get here these two terms and dxj dxi. But now we are summing only over the ordered indices. And let's spell this out. Remember, this is all happening still in R3. Then what do we get? We have dx1, dx2, dx3, and the bases in the space of two forms is given by these three vectors, right? This is a basis vector, dx1, dx2, dx1, dx3, dx2, dx3, and there are no others, because remember, the basis vectors have them all ordered. Otherwise, we would be double counting. Otherwise, we would have, you know, for example, dx2, dx1, is up to a sign the same as that. So it's not an independent basis vector. And the coefficients in front are those. And if you collect those coefficients, then you recognize that you've seen them before. They are the coefficients of the curl vector. Right? You may have seen that before in electrodynamics, for example. And it's, again, three components. So it looks as if it was actually a vector. But the curl vector is not a vector, actually. Because what we see here is that the curl actually consists of is a covariant two tensor. It is actually a two form because we started with the one form, and then the d of that, the beta, is a two form. So this is a two form, and these are the three coefficients of two forms. It just so happens that in R3, the space of two forms is three dimensional, and therefore it looks as if the two forms are vectors, but they're not. They transform differently. From the physics perspective, they transform a bit differently. There are odd minus signs that can come in there. OK, so we can collect those three coefficients, and then it can be misunderstood as a vector, but it's really a two-form field. It's sometimes called a pseudo-vector field. Now, I don't want to scroll all that way. Okay. Now, if you remember from electrodynamics, a gradient vector field is curl-free. Gradient vector field is curl-free. Remember that? That's a special case of d after d is equal to zero. Right? Because that's df, and that's another d on that. Okay. Now, what we see here is that it's important to know whether a differential form is of the form that it's the d of something. It's also important to know whether a differential form is annihilated by applying d to it. And those two scenarios have special names. A differential form omega is called closed if, when you apply the d to it, it's zero. So for example, dxi. All the dxi's are closed, because if you apply the d to that, it's zero. But it's just an example. There are many more closed differential forms. So whenever you have a beta, which is the d gamma, is d gamma, then we know that the beta is closed, right? Because if you apply the d to that, then you get a d squared. And then a differential form omega is called exact if there exists a new of which it is the exterior derivative. And what we see immediately is that if a differential form is exact, then clearly it's closed too. Because if a differential form is the exterior derivative of new, then if we apply the exterior derivative to that, we get a d squared, it's zero. So therefore it's closed. So we can immediately tell that every exact differential form is also closed. By the way, just to as a mnemonic device to remember that, see, a differential form is called exact if it is the exterior derivative of a nu. And remember that the omega has to be of a fine-tuned form. It has to be of the form d nu by dx1, comma d nu by dx2, comma etc. Right? So it has to be exactly right in order to have an antiderivative in the form of nu, right? So a differential form is called exact if it's just exactly of the right form that there exists a nu whose exterior derivative it is. And closed means, you know, if you apply a d to it, that vanishes. OK, now, how are closeness and exactness related? Actually, very closely related. It turns out that this depends on the global topology of the manifold. Remember, the word topology has two meanings in mathematics. It deals with open neighborhoods and that stuff. But it also deals with, I mean, the word is also used for a completely different question, namely, does the manifold have holes? Does it have handles? Is it like a donut? Is it like a pretzel? That's the field of topology. That's another field that's also called topology. Now, in the simplest case, I mean, there's a deep relationship between closed and exact differential forms, and we will get much more about this. But for now, let me just mention to you Poincaré's lemma. And for that, let us introduce the notion of contractible manifolds. Imagine we have a manifold like this, and this is a point that's called x0. Then this manifold is contractible in the sense that there's a continuous map which shrinks the manifold in a continuous way, so that all points move and become x naught in the limit. On the other hand, if our manifold has a hole in it, then I cannot do that in a continuous way, because I would have to rip the manifold open so that all points can travel to x naught. Because the point up over here has to travel either this way or that way to x naught, right? And at some point, I have to rip the manifold and decide, OK, these points go this way and those points go that way. They can't all go the same way. I have to rip it somewhere, right? So it can't have it continuous. So if a manifold is contractible, then the so-called Poincaré lemma holds. And it says that on contractible manifolds, we have that the set of exact differential forms is the same as the set of closed differential forms. And what that means is that there is a very simple method in this case to determine whether or not a differential form is integrable, whether or not a differential form has an antiderivative, right? Because what this says is you can simply check whether it's closed. So you apply the D to it. You check is you check, let's say you want to know whether omega is the D of nu. So you ask, does there exist a nu such that omega is the D of nu? And normally that's hard to check. But in this case, it's easy to check because you can check whether D omega is equal to 0. Right, that is easy. Just differentiate and check whether all the coefficient functions are 0. And if so, then omega is closed. If not, then omega is not closed. And by Poincaré's lemma, if omega is closed, then there exists such a nu. And if omega is not closed, then there doesn't exist such a nu. Now, isn't that weird? Isn't that weird that in this way, we can distinguish between whether or not a manifold has a hole or not, right? Because you can check, and this is a local check, you know, you can check at every x whether or not this condition holds. And the point here is that when we talk about integration, integration is a non-local thing. Because if you have a function and you integrate it, then what you're doing is the integral of the function at this point is actually summing up all the area here, right? So it knows about the neighborhood. It's the accumulation of what the function did. The integral has a memory, so to speak, right? And roughly speaking, that's the reason why a local check for the derivative to vanish can tell you whether or not there exists an antiderivative, whether there exists a nu of which the omega is the d. See, in fact, you can turn this into a method for finding out whether or not a manifold is contractible. Because let's say you don't know whether the manifold is contractible. Then what you can do is you can simply check whether Poincaré's lemma is true or not. And if it's not true, well then, if it is true, then you know. No, if it's not true, then it can't be a contractible manifold. In fact, this is this observation was the beginning of a whole branch of mathematics, which then became so big that it can now be seen as a new foundation of all of mathematics. How does that go? Of course, I'm already a little bit over time, but I thought I spent these 5 minutes on that. OK, so I'm going off on a little bit of a tangent here, but trust me, it's going to be interesting. OK, so in general, we know that if a differential form is exact, then it is also closed, right? If it's a D of something, then another D applied to it makes it 0. So clear, exact follows closed because of that. But since the reverse is not necessarily true, we obtain here a tool for classifying manifolds, checking whether they have holes or handles or how many handles and so on. And what can we do here is, what we can do here is, we check how big is the space of closed differential forms, how big is the space of exact differential forms. And if we notice that the space of closed differential forms is larger than the space of exact differential forms, then we know something's up. And we can measure how much, by how many dimensions they differ. And that gives us valuable information. So for example, we can check one forms. How many closed one forms do we have? How many exact one forms do we have? What's the number of dimensions difference? That's the first Betti number. And then you can ask, you know, what is the difference in dimensions between the number of closed, the dimension of closed two forms and exact two forms. And again, you know, you get a difference in the dimensions, and all of these numbers tell you something about the topology of the manifold. This study is a special case of a cohomology theory called Devram cohomology. What is a cohomology theory in general? A cohomology theory is a map from differentiable manifolds into abelian, that is to say, commutative groups. In the special case that I just talked about, the differentiable manifolds is, you know, the manifolds that we talk about. But what are the groups? Well, vector spaces. A vector space is, among other things, a group with respect to the addition. And it's a commutative group with respect to addition. So we map into, in this case, into the vector space. We take the manifold and we map it into the vector space of closed but not exact differential forms, and then check what the dimension might be of that. And the point is that a cohomology theory maps differentiable manifolds into abelian groups in such a way that if the differentiable manifolds are not isomorphic, because, for example, one doesn't have handles and the other one has handles, one is a pretzel, the other is a donut, then they can't be differentiably invertibly mapped onto each other. But then the groups that we map into should also not be isomorphic. If that's guaranteed, then we have a cohomology theory. And what it does is it takes the complicated objects that are differentiable manifolds and maps them into simple things like commutative groups. Right? And then if the commutative groups are not isomorphic, then neither can the manifolds be diffeomorphic. And so we can classify a hard problem using simpler methods. So we're taking sort of a rough snapshot of the manifold. We're extracting some rough properties of them using a cohomology theory. So why are cohomology theories useful? Because it's much easier to check whether two abelian groups are isomorphic than it is to check whether two manifolds are isomorphic. And remember that these manifolds may not be anything that we can visualize. The dimension may be too high. It might be a manifold of differential equations or solutions of differential equations. Very, very hard to visualize. But we may still want to know whether that solution space has holes in it or not, right? And it's very hard to visualize. But if we then have a good cohomology theory, we can map that into abelian groups and then learn something about the connectivity properties of these manifolds. Okay. Right, I said that already. And now let's look at the even bigger picture. Because as I said, from this, mathematics grew a new branch which can be viewed as being as fundamental as logic and set theory. How does that go? Well, it turns out that cohomology theories, which map differentiable manifolds into abelian groups, are a special case of what is a special application of category theory. And category theory was developed for that purpose. It grew much larger then, though. So all cohomology theories are so-called natural transformations between two categories. In this case, the category of differentiable manifolds and the category of abelian groups. Now, I have to tell you what a category is. So what is a category? A category is something with very little structure. A category is a set of objects and morphisms. So the objects are elements, right? We call them objects, but they're really just elements of the set. And then there are arrows between these elements. And the rules of the game are that in order to qualify, for a set to qualify to be called a category, it has to have a bunch of axioms, and here are the most important ones. If there's an arrow from object A to object B, and another arrow from object B to object C, then there has to be an arrow from object A to object C. This is motivated by the idea that if A is isomorphic to B and B is isomorphic to C, then A should be isomorphic to C. Right? That's the ultimate motivation for this. And then these arrows should be associative. And also every element, every object has an arrow back to itself. And there are some other axioms there. But overall, it's just a bunch of axioms and sets of elements that are elements and arrows between them called objects and so-called morphisms. The morphisms are arrows between objects. Okay, so here are examples. There is the category of vector spaces. So every dot in here, every element is a vector space. And then there will be morphisms between them, isomorphisms, right? There will be morphisms from vector space to vector space. And if there's a morphism from this to this and that to that, then there's got to be one from here to there. I didn't plot all of them, right? And the morphisms will be linear transformations. And then we can consider the category of associative algebras, for example, or the category of Lie algebras. The objects are Lie algebras, or associative algebras, or whatever we may want to consider. The morphisms are then the algebra homomorphisms. That is to say, arrows that connect two algebras have to be such that whether you first multiply in an algebra and then map the result into the new algebra, or you first take the two elements and map them into the new algebra and then multiply, should be the same. So all these are examples of categories. And here's also the category of abelian groups, the category of differentiable manifolds, right? So abelian groups, the objects are abelian groups. And then the group homomorphisms are the morphisms. And for differentiable manifolds, the objects are the differentiable manifolds. And the morphisms are diffeomorphisms between them, invertible differentiable maps between them. And then, and this is what makes it so cool and powerful, there's also the category of categories, right? Where you have, each point is a category. Here you have the abelian groups, you have the non-abelian groups, you have the Lie algebras and the vector spaces and so on, right? And you can consider morphisms from one object to the other. For example, from the category of differentiable manifolds to the category of abelian groups. That was the first example, right? And then you have the arrows in between the morphisms, but they are called natural transformations if they map, if they are morphisms in the category of categories. So a cohomology theory is a morphism between two objects in the category of categories, namely the differentiable, the category of differentiable manifolds and the category of the abelian groups. So how does this work? Here's the category of differentiable manifolds. Here's the category of abelian groups. Every differentiable manifold is mapped by this cohomology theory into an abelian group, such as a vector space of closed but not exact differentiable forms. And here we have another manifold mapped into another abelian group. And for example, let's say we know that this differentiable manifold is a sphere. And this one, we don't know what it is. But it, if it is deformable in a continuous way into this, there should be a diffeomorphism between the two, right? We may want, but it might be secretly a pretzel. We haven't found out yet, right? And then we don't know whether there exists a diffeomorphism between them. But that's where the cohomology theory comes in. We map this into an abelian group, map that into an abelian group. And if the cohomology theory is well designed, it means that if we can determine that the two abelian groups are not isomorphic, then there cannot exist a diffeomorphism here either. Unfortunately, it doesn't work the other way around. Just because two groups are isomorphic doesn't mean that the manifolds have a diffeomorphism in between them. So this is really a rough picture of what's going on in the manifold. And in general, It's not clear. Actually, it's believed that it doesn't exist, one cohomology theory that rules them all, right? Okay. But you see, the category of categories is a very strong concept, and it captures the idea of a structure in mathematics, right? Because any branch of mathematics is just a dot in there. Okay, and then let me just give you another example. That K-theory is also an example of a cohomology theory. It is also a natural transformation from the category of differentiable manifolds into the category of abelian groups. So it's also what is called a functor. It's mapping from one category to another. And for K-theory, the strategy is a slightly different one. But of course, again, the idea is that if the abelian groups are different, these manifolds don't have diffeomorphism between them. So one might be a pretzel and the other one might be a donut or something. Okay, so remember here, for K-theory, the key idea is this. There's only one way to put a vector bundle on a contractible manifold, but on a general manifold, there are many different ways to put vector bundles on there. Remember the example that we had when we introduced vector bundles, right? You have that this region is isomorphic to the base space tensor of the fiber, and so is this, but the isomorphisms might not be the same. And so just like with the Möbius band, you can have, you know, some non-trivial map here at this overlap. And essentially, K-theory is counting how many ways there are to put non-trivially different ways there are to put vector bundles on a manifold. And it turns out that K-theory classifies manifolds somewhat differently from how Derham cohomology does. And so the things you can distinguish with Derham cohomology, you cannot distinguish with K-theory sometimes, and vice versa. So ideally, we would just accumulate such theories and get a better and better view of what's going on in differentiable manifolds. But you know, category theory and natural transformations are used all over the place. You can also use that, for example, to categorize and classify knots in knot theory, for example. So in any case, it's very cool because it's super abstract and therefore super powerful because it's so broad. Okay, that's as far as we got today, and I have to rush to the university. All right.